And then we can see that RAM and disk, which is the primary topic of this dissertation, they both consume 40% of the total power of the servers. Okay. Now, that 40%, if you compare with the 80% in the whole data center, that gives a total of 32% consumed just by memory and disk. That's the same as $144 million compared to the $450 that we saw earlier. And this pie chart we saw here is when the system is fully utilized, right? So this is in its peak power. But when the load goes down, given that the CPU is proportional, the CPU share will go down. And then the share of the RAM and the disk will be even higher. Now, the price of the energy is not coming down anytime soon. In the last decade, it has just gone up. So this will still be a valid problem in the future. Now, in this situation, as I said, we're going to focus on disk and memory, mainly on disk, as we will say. And we will give some insights of how we can save power and memory. So the benefits of reducing the power cost is that, well, of course, we reduce the data center's operation costs to start. But also, we have additional benefits like longer-lasting battery in mobile devices like laptops. So the problem here is that the challenge of saving power is that usually saving power comes with a trade-off of performance. Right? So usually, to save power, you need to sacrifice a little bit of performance, or at least in the design of your energy efficient system, you need to be careful not to affect performance. So let me give some examples of what I'm saying. For instance, in the case of disk, the only way to save power in a single disk is by making a stop rotating, right? Or it's on another disk. Now, the problem is that if the application accesses a disk which is spun down, then it has to incur a delay of several seconds. Right? So you can see here clearly the trade-off of performance that energy saving could have. And also, in the case of memory, well, given that the memory is not, forgot the word, it's not persistent, it has to refresh itself frequently in order to keep the data that it has in. Right? Now, one way, the only way to really save power of these refresh of the energy used by refreshing is by reducing the RAM, for instance, and replace that with some other device like a flash, which is lower power use. And then, of course, the paging activity will increase, which will make the performance of the application slow. Okay. So there are several solutions for all these problems for disk and memory. So I will talk a little bit about those current solutions. So the first solution is, of course, to spin down the disk, as I said, but now requests can have a delay of even seconds. And the other problem is that applications usually do not allow long idle times for the disk in order to spin down. Now, you can also try to make long idle periods of time by making a power aware RAM caching and doing it aggressive. Right? So the idea is to buffer longer for longer time or even prefetching more aggressively in order to keep the disk idle longer. The problem with this solution is that the memory may not be big enough to hold all the working set of the application, and the memory is not persistent. So if we buffer for too long, we may have data loss. Now, another solution is to use an external device to cache your data. And basically, what it's doing is expanding the RAM, and now we have the potential to hold a bigger working share. And also, if that device is persistent, we also don't have the problem of persistence that the normal RAM would have. Now, if we have multiple disks, then we can also duplicate data between these disks, and then we can serve the data from just a smaller subset, and we can power out the rest of the disks. Right? In terms of the memory, there are two solutions. One first is to increase locality. This will make sure that the active power of RAM will be reduced. Or use multi-power RAM, which basically adapts the amount of power required depending on how much bandwidth you use of the RAM. Turns out that for all these solutions, there is already a publication. So we'll focus on these two and three or four and the memory. First, in three, there is a solution for external caching, but it's usually simulation, so they don't really explore the challenges that implementing these external caching would have in a real operating system. And in multi systems, there is a publication already for it, but it caches too aggressively, or it tries to compact everything in one single disk and try to power down all the remaining disks. But the problem is that once this disk does not support the load of the system, then all the disks need to be powered up. Right? So there is not really proportionality in this case. There is still two levels. And in the case of memory, even though these two save power on the active power of the RAM, it still have the idle power problems. You still have to refresh all the RAM. So in this dissertation, we want to reduce the energy consumption of computer systems, here mainly disks and somewhat memory. And we do that by first designing a multi-disk energy proportional storage system that use only commodity devices. Second, we design and implement our energy efficient storage system using flash to cache all data, as much data as possible, and leave the disk alone so it can power down and consume less power. Right? So it will reduce the consumption, the energy consumption of disk. And finally, we design and implement a new mechanism to eliminate the blocking read operation due to a page write, and that could otherwise restore the disk. So this would help definitely the two previous ones, and keep them in the low power mode, and also can slow down the application. We'll talk about all this in the next slides. So here I have the contributions of the dissertation. So we work in three areas, different areas. First, we have we save power in multi-disk systems, then in single-disk system, and finally we have a solution that it can be used for multiple purposes, as we'll see later. In the multi-disk system, we increase the proportionality of this of the energy used by disks. This is called SOC map. In single disk system, we extend the RAM with an external device that can cache data so that this can be live alone for long period of times and be powered up. We call that excess. And in the multipurpose one, we identify and solve the fetch before update problem that I will explain later. And this will allow us to break some dependencies in how the writes happen. So for now, I will start with SRC map. And SRC map is concerned about the proportionality of how much energy uses the disk depending on how much load it has. Now the problem is that usually in data centers, disks are provisioned for peak loads. Right? like in this case, there are 8 disks. So the idea is that when a peak load comes, the disks are able to serve all of them with a certain guarantees. Now, usually, in average, what happens is that the load is much lower than the peak load that for what the disk provisions. It's more in the order of 10 to 30%. Right? So, now the problem here is that even though the load is usually 10 or 30%, the power, given that disks are non-proportional, the power of use by this storage system would be always the same. It doesn't matter how much load it has. Now, this, of course, will be worse given that CPUs are more energy proportional. And there are well-known techniques to save power by consolidating machines in virtualized cells. Right? Now the question is, can we use a storage virtualization layer that can redirect IOs as we want for a practical layer proportional storage system? Now, the storage virtualization ion direction is very useful for consolidation because now we can redirect IOs wherever we want. Now, the challenge here is that we don't want to move much data. In particular, moving a logical volume from one physical vault to another is prohibitively expensive. So we need to just move what is necessary to be able to do that. So here's an overview of SRC map. First, the architecture of the system in which we're working. First, we have logical volumes for which we receive requests, which is a per volume LVA. And then in the storage virtualization manager, it will rate those IOs to the right physical location in the physical volumes. That's a basic idea. Now, in SRC map, we start by reserving a scratch space in all physical volumes, a small scratch space. Next, we detect just the working set of each physical volume, and the working set is defined as the blocks that were accessed in some period of time. Usually it was very long period of time. Probably, I don't know, I know that was a couple of hours or days. We replicate those working sets in the scratch space that we reserved earlier. Right? For instance, in the scratch space of A, we store the working set of C, we store the working set of E. In the B, we store the working set of D, and so on. Now, when the load goes down, we can serve all the IOs from just a subset of the physical volumes. So we can turn off, for instance, 3 of the disks and just work with 2 disks, and then we can save power. Now, those disks that are turned off, they will be spawned down depending on the load, right? So if we have more load, we can spawn up another one and so on. So we will keep on as many disks as load we have. So to summarize on SRC map, first it's a new storage virtualization solution to keep proportionality in the amount of energy we use depending on the load. In our experiments, we found that it achieves 1 energy level per disk with low space overhead because we're just replicating working sets. And we have workload shift adaptation, so every time there is a new IO to the or a new block to the working set, we adapt to that. We implemented and evaluated a prototype with real workload block traces. We were able to save at least 35% of the power, and we were able to spawn down half of the disks on average on a system of 8 disks. Okay. So we saw that there was very small amounts of IOs that actually missed the working set. In our case, it was 0.003% of all ions to wait for a spin-off delay. And finally, we found that the synchronization to adapt to shift to shift in the workload were actually affecting the performance. So it's important to keep that in mind. Now, the impact of SRC map is that an administrator using SRC map, it only has to tune SRC map with some minimal initial manual tuning, and then it just can forget about it, and just the system can save power by itself. So it has low burden on administrators. And also, we found that SRC map can have even better results in data centers, where typically the number of disks are much higher than the prototype we tried, which were 8 disks. So that means that we will have in a data center much more energy levels than we have in our prototypes. Now, we said that we achieve one energy level per disk, which is fine, but what happens when you have one single disk? If you have one single disk, you cannot use this idea because if you turn off a disk, then you cannot serve the data from anywhere else, right? So we have a solution for single disk systems. This is called external caching for energy efficient storage. We call it EXIS. And the idea here is to extend the memory with an additional device, flash device in this case, and then we can cache, prefetch, and write buffering, and write buffer data in that flash. So we can keep disks idle for longer period of time, and then they can spawn in on and save power. In the goals, we need to make effective use of external flash caching by adapting to workload changes. It's important to adapt to workload changes because then in the future we can we don't need to, or we will decrease the likelihood of additional IOs to this. And we also need to ensure block level consistency in all system states to keep the reliability of the data. Now, I have a small diagram of how EXIS would work. We have four components here, the operating system, application, the flash, and the disk. Basically, what would happen is that the operating system will redirect all IOs or as much IOs as you can to the flash. But when the data is going flash, we have to follow the normal path and then wake up the disk if it's sleeping. Now, to adapt to the workload changes, we need to do a periodic reconfiguration that will update the blocks that are in flash, and so in the future we can redirect more and more IOs. Now let's see a small example of what EXIS will do. Here I have a graph in time, and the red dots are IOs, right? How the disk will see IOs. So in the vanilla case, the operating system is not trying to optimize for longer periods of idle time. So this will see just a normal pattern. Now, if we do aggressive caching on RAM, then we can prefetch and buffer data more aggressively. So we will definitely see that some of the IOs will cluster, and then we have longer periods of idleness, but because in RAM usually does not cannot hold all the working set, we will see that there are still some misses, right? So we still would have to bother the disk to get the data we need. Now, in the case of EXIS, because now we have more memory, we can hold a bigger working set, and then we have longer periods of idle time, right? So the disks have a better chance of being asleep. Now, we designed and implemented EXIS for Linux, and then we evaluated access on a laptop using a USB and a Combat Plus external drives. We used the desktop and developer and server workloads to do the evaluation. And we have an overall savings of 2 to 14% across these workloads. We also found that having external caching can have a substantial impact in performance. We found that it was up to 14x. And the impact of having excess is that, well, with a better energy, we could have a better energy efficiency in mobile devices, like a laptop, by simply plugging an external device, right, which are widely available and also cheap. Now, so far, we have talked about SRC map and access that can take power on multi-disk system and single-disk systems. Okay? Both of them are basically a caching systems to save power. So the idea is that their efficiency will be better as more IOs are redirected to the cache, right? But what happens when the IO misses? Well, first, if there is a read that is not in cache, then there is no way around it. We need to wake up the primary device to read the whatever we need. If we have a full page write, then we can buffer the page in the external device, well, or in the caching device. But when we have smaller writes, we again need or require the disadvantage, because now we need to merge the smaller write in the full block, right? So for that, we developed this system called non-blocking writes, which basically breaks this dependency that we have to read a block in order to be able to merge the small write we need. And now let's talk about that next. So first, I want to explain non-blocking writes. Non-blocking writes work for any kind of cache. Now, I will exemplify here basically on what, how non-blocking writes would work for an operating system normal cache. So usually the problem here is that the memory access generality is smaller than disks. And that means that writing to an out-of-core page will require a full page fetch. So let's see how that process would usually work. First, we try to the process tries to write to a page which is not in memory, so it will bother the operating system saying, "Okay, I don't have the page to write." So the operating system will issue the fetch, and finally we have the page in memory. Then it will return control to the process, and finally the process can do the write that it was trying to do originally. Okay? So the question here is, well, why applications have to request and wait for the data, which they actually don't need, right, to move forward? So we saw this behavior in Linux, BSD, and SAN, all of them very well-known operating systems, OIP systems. And let's see how non-blocking writes would handle this situation. So we have our three components, process, backend, store, and operating system. So the process tries to write to a page, again, which is not in memory, and then the operating system handles the needs. Now, before, we will issue the fetch right away, but now, instead of issuing the fetch, we first create a patch. So now we create a patch of what the application is trying to write, so we can use later. Now we issue the fetch, and next we return control to the application. Right? Now you see here that before returning control to the process, we are not waiting on the I/O. So basically, the process does not have to wait for I/O before it can move forward. Now the IO can complete, and finally we can merge whatever patch we created. Now this operation that we have with non-blocking IO has two basic benefits. First, it reduces the access latency to bays that are not in memory, because now we don't have to wait for IO. And finally, it can also increase the backend store bandwidth, because we're able to keep more than one outstanding IO, one outstanding fetch, even when we have a single thread application. So I will talk about these two benefits. We'll explain in more detail these two benefits. So first, the page fetch asynchrony, how non-blocking was will help in that. So first, let's see what will happen in the normal system. This is time, of course. Now the application tried to write a page P, but this dash means that it cannot write because it's not in memory. So it has to wait for the request of file P to finish so that P can be in memory. And then it can finally do a write. Then we have some thinking time, probably some processing on the page P. And then we read P, right? We have some additional thinking time. Now, what would happen in non-blocking writes? In non-blocking writes, first, the application tries to write page P, but now it is successful because it doesn't have to wait for it. So now it has the same thinking time that it has in the blocking write case. And then a read comes. But now, note that P is not yet in memory, right? So now the reading P has to wait, and that's the waiting IO that it has, and it can finally read P, right? Now we have this other thinking time after that, and that's how non-blocking write would work. So notice that non-blocking write is able to save this amount of time by basically overlapping the computation with the IO, right? So basically here, this thinking time is happening at the same time that the IO, so we are able to save that amount of time. And also, we're able to immediately return from a write to an out of core page. Now, what happened, how non-blocking writes achieve parallelism? So for that, I have another example. First, again, we try to write a page P, which is not in memory, so we have to wait for IO. Then we try to write a page P, which is not in memory again, and then we'll read P, let's say. So in non-blocking write, what would happen is that it tries to write P, but it can return right away because the page is, we have non-blocking write and we don't depend on the IO. And then we try to write P, right? Here we write B, so we try to write B, and it will return immediately because again we don't depend on the IO. And finally, we try to read B, but it's not yet in memory, so it has to wait for all the IOs here. And then you see that in this case we're able to have both IOs happening in parallel at the same time, while in the blocking write case we have. We need to complete them in sequence. This increased IO parallelism, so we can use better devices that can handle multiple IOs at the same time. But also, it can increase the efficiency of the scheduler because the scheduler has more IOs to work with. Now, so far, we have seen that this asynchrony and parallelism help performance, but I said earlier that non-blocking writes was multi-purpose. So the question is, okay, how non-blocking write helps in other areas other than performance? So for that, I will do a slight change on how non-blocking write would work. Again, we try to write a page that is in memory, and we give a miss. And again, we create a patch. But now, since the application doesn't need to wait for the IO, why we have to wait for the IO, right? Instead, we can return right away and the application can continue processing. But now at some point we need to fetch the page. Now for that we introduce a new component which we call an oracle. which will trigger when that fetch is going to happen. Then we issue the page fetch, we complete the page, and we apply the patch. Okay? Now, this oracle, the policy to bring that page, depends on what is the goal of the system. So the oracle has several uses. One use could be to save power by delaying fetches when the disks are not spinning up. This, of course, helps access an SRC map because now we don't have to do fetches that we did before to do a small write. And this oracle can also help systems under resource pressure. For instance, if the disk is under high load, then the fetch can be delayed for later. Or if we are under memory pressure, perhaps it's not the best time to allocate a full fetch, right, to do the fetch. Now, we did an evaluation of non-blocking writes. We implemented non-blocking for Linux and for x86. And in this case, we're only evaluating the asynchronous mode of non-blocking writes for performance, which is the first version of non-blocking writes we have. We have 10 workloads, 4 spec CPU, which are single-threaded, 4 the DACAPO benchmarks, which are multi-threaded. We have a spec SFS, which is a file server workload, and we also have a spec power, which is basically an application server with various loads. So we'll focus now in just these two sets of workloads, spec CPU for single thread and a couple for multi-thread. So let's start with the single thread. Okay, so first, we have our 4 workloads. And then we run each of them 5 times, and we found a coefficient of variation of less than 2%, so it has a low variance. In this graph, in the x-axis, we have the improvement in that in one of these I/O CPU tokens, which means if we have an improvement in I/O, it means that we decrease the amount of time we have to wait for I/O. If we have an increase in CPU, we use less CPU and so on. And total is basically combining both. So we start with I/O. The first thing we see, ignoring this one for now, we see that non-blocking writing is able to decrease the amount of time the application is waiting for I/O. Right? So we have 3% less in GCC, 3% less of waiting for I/O, and in the other case we have 4% waiting for I/O. In this case we have to wait a little bit for I/O extra, but it's really small. So it doesn't make a big difference, first, and second, I still think it's probably noise, as is in this case. So now let's see what happened with the CPU. Well, it turns out that with the CPU, non-blocking write here, which is, I guess, more clear the pattern, non-blocking write increase the amount of CPU that is used by the application. Now, this makes sense because even though the application doesn't have to wait for the I/O to finish, it can, while the I/O is happening, it can use the CPU, right? And that increases the time that is being used by the CPU. Now, this is the total. It's basically how much was non-blocking writes able to save in time. So what we see is that non-blocking write was able to, in the best case, it was able to reduce execution time by 2%. But although it seems small, I calculated that the maximum amount of time that it can save is 6.2. So it's basically a 2.1% gain out of a maximum of 6.2. Now, you can think that the memory overhead of non-blocking write can be high if we continuously create patches for the same page, but we found that this is usually very small and typically less than 0.1% of the total memory provision for the system. Now, when we try multi-thread applications, we have pretty much the same graph with 4 different workloads. Now, these are the multi-thread workloads. And because they are multi-threaded and less deterministic, the coefficient operation was much higher. So in this case, the pattern we see, if we ignore Bagley for now, the pattern we see is that we were able to save time or wait less per hour, but we're also, again, using more the CPU. Now, what we found in the multi-threaded case was that usually the amount of extra CPU use surpasses the gains we have by not waiting for hours. Okay? For instance, in the case of PMD, we have close to 15% of CPU, of more CPU use, but we have only 10% of less time waiting for hours, right? So at the end, we have a degraded performance of non-blocking value. So in the worst case, we have 80% of degradation, and this is basically because the additional CPU time that we use surpasses the hour waiting benefits. So in this particular case, in the VATIC case, we see that non-blocking value is waiting more for hours. Actually, we're not sure why that happened. We're still looking into why that happens. But the good news is that only happened in one out of the 10 workloads we were using, so it's not a common pattern. Okay, so now let's see why we have this situation. I mean, why non-blocking write is degrading the performance in multi-thread applications. So we think this is due to a suboptimal scaling of the CPU. So to understand the problem, I have here a small sample. The initial stage is we have a single CPU and we have two processes. The red process is a process which is constantly faulting, trying to write to a page that is not in memory, right? So you can say that that process is the one that will take better or more benefits out of non-blocking writes because it will be able to unblock an each write. So what will happen in the vanilla case is that P1 comes to the CPU, and of course it generates a fault, so what happens is that the operating system issues the fetch and put P1 to wait until that fetch is done. And then P2, for which all the memory, all the data is in memory and doesn't need to fetch anything, it can now keep the CPU and make progress. Okay? What would happen in non-blocking writes is that non-blocking write doesn't have to wait for IO, now P1 will keep the CPU while the IO is happening. Now, the problem with this is that P1 is constantly doing non-blocking writes, it's constantly doing faults, which is much slower than just running P2 that can access the data in memory without any operating system iterations, right? So now we know that this is the problem. So what are the possible solutions? Well, the first possible solution is to have multiple CPUs. So if we have multiple CPUs, then we can run P1 and P2 into different cores. Even though P1 cannot progress faster because it has to go up and down all the time with the operating system, it doesn't matter because it's not bothering P2, right? P2 is able to progress fast as well. So in this situation, we will have that problem. But now we still have the problem because if we have more than two threads, we can have two threads, which are basically creating patches, and now both threads take both CPUs, right? So this is more or less a partial solution. So for that, we create an additional solution, which basically yields the CPU. Now, if the operating system detects that P1 is creating many patches, then it can yield the CPU and give a chance to another process and see if that process is able to progress faster than what the current process is doing. Right? So what would happen in this case is that first we start with this situation. P1 is constantly going to the faulting in the operating system creating patches. So the operating system will detect that situation and will kill the CPU, and will come to this case, because now the P2 will be scheduled and it will run. So, to summarize the results, first, non-blockery allows synchronous writes to pages in memory by breaking the dependency between the writes to pages that are not in memory and the fetch itself. Now, in our evaluation of server and developer workloads, we found that a non-blocking write is able to reduce 2.1% in our best case, the execution time for single thread application, but remember that this is out of a maximum of 6.2%. Now, here we have an experiment that didn't show, but it's in the dissertation, where for file server, we are able to reduce the write latency of the writes by 50%. The rest, the read latency and so on, are pretty much the same, but now, because the writes do not depend on the backing store, we're able to reduce that to 50%. But we also found a degradation in performance with multi-threaded workloads. But the good news is that we have a direction we think we know the problem, and we have a direction to solve that problem. The impact of non-blocking writes. Well, first we show that it has the potential to increase the effectiveness of SRC map and access by delaying even further IOs to the primary storage that should be spawned out. It can also achieve better performance by decoupling the write to our core pages from the backing store. And third, this can improve, as I show, non-blocking writes have the potential to help when the resources are constrained in a system. So it can improve the ability of a reduced memory energy efficient system, right? And cut some of the idle power in memory. Now, in the conclusions, first, I demonstrated that it's important to solve the energy problem in disk and memory. And we found that caching techniques are very effective to save power in disks. In the case of multi-disk systems, we saved 36% of energy saving. That was the minimum savings. And in the case of single-disk system, we saved 2%, 2 to 14% of the energy. We also eliminated the page first before update with non-blocking writes. We were able to reduce the execution time of the single-thread applications. We were able to reduce up to 50% the average latency of file server workloads. We saw that there is a performance degradation in multi-thread applications, but we also proposed some solutions. And we found that non-blocking writes has the potential to improve the power even further in Nexus and SRC map, and also to improve the performance in resource-constrained systems. For future work, and by the way, I couldn't think of future work so far. Yeah. So for future work, we think that the next big challenge is memory itself. Now, with the increasing popularity of SSD, storage share of energy in a server will be smaller, and the next bigger consumer will be memory, of course. Now, memory also continues to increase, of course, and as it continues to increase, the amount of RAM that it uses continues to increase linearly. With that, I finished my presentation. Here I have my publications. These are publications that I presented here. The design implementation of blocking writes on the review. And then we also have a number of references. for each application as a metric of how influential, I guess, was the paper. In turn, on blocking rate, it's really new, so we don't have a reference. So we have zero references, but at least it's happy. And next, we have some additional publications not directly related to this work. There's also I work during my PhD. Finance accomplishments, and that's basically it. How much time?
You did pretty good on time.
Look at the minutes.
45 minutes.
45.
Good.
Yeah. Okay, let's do, how did you feel, first of all?
I feel okay. I think I can do a couple of modifications, but it's not bad.
Okay. All right, let's do questions. You guys have any questions, comments?
Yeah, I have a couple of questions. Let's see. Okay, so first of all, let me start by the end. So non-blocking writes, it uses more CPU, right?
Yes.
But you also argue that it will potentially increase, it will potentially be better for power efficiency.
Yes.
So how come if you use more CPU, and CPU consumes a lot of energy,
yes,
it could be more power efficient?
That's a good question. I actually, that's one of the things. I don't know exactly what would happen. I think we need to check if the balance is still positive.
Okay.
But I think it will be. Okay.
You have to say that you think you can, but because for me it wasn't clear how that could be.
Okay.
Happening.
You mean you didn't know if I actually did the work or not?
Exactly. Because
okay.
You stated as a fact. For me that was like, but I couldn't see how that could
okay.
Happen.
Yeah, it's just, I don't really know by fact. I haven't done the experiments, but, yeah.
So also,
on that comment, you might want to look into how CPU power is consumed and how it is saved. And that might give you some sense for, how much additional power this additional CPU utilization will require.
Because most of the utilization comes from handling faults, right?
Yes.
Increased utilization. So the other question I have,
just on that, what I really mean is that the CPU power consumption, how dynamic can it be with the dynamic voltage frequency scaling technology? If you have 2% additional CPU utilization, does it mean 2% additional power consumption? Does it mean that? Right. That's
mm-hmm.
that's really what you need to look
mm-hmm.
into.
So what happens if one of those writes is actually a write barrier?
A write barrier.
A non-blocking write, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're writing just one block instead of a whole page, just to say that this just
okay.
to indicate that it's a write barrier and
how do you indicate that it's a barrier?
The application knows it, but not the OS.
Okay.
Right, so will that affect negatively the implications that the OS and or the application has?
Okay.
The guarantees.
Well, the only guarantees that the operating system offer to the application is if the application do f-sync. In the case it does f-sync, at the end of that f-sync, if you didn't have an error, you can be for sure that your data is in disk.
Okay, so what happens if the application is issuing an f-sync?
An f-sync.
Yeah.
Well, in that case, what would happen is that, the data will be in disk. What would happen is that F-sync inside the operating system will wait for that page until the fetch is finished and all the patches are applied,
mm-hmm.
and then it will do the write. So the consistency is maintained.
Okay.
So the non-blocking write will be converted into a blocking write.
Yes.
Or
in that case, it will.
Okay.
Yes.
Write operation.
Yes.
Okay. Okay. So the increase in CPU activity is mainly because of the additional pods.
Yes.
Right. So and you talked about that when you the one of the things that you could do is just yield the CPU when you detect that that's going up.
Yes, but that's only for multi-thread applications.
For multi-thread applications. Exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
To deal with the problem on multi-thread applications.
Okay. So how would you go and detect that that's going that you're having that problem? You will somehow watermark a given number of CPU.
We have thought about a couple of things, but basically you can detect that. What I was thinking is count the amount of time the application is spending creating these patches, right?
Mm-hmm.
If the application is spending 100% of the time creating patches, then it's creating a lot of patches, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the idea, and I actually don't show it here, but the thing is that you can have multiple threads which are a different level of how many patches they are creating, right? So you can have a thread that is creating 100% of the time patches, one that is creating 50% of the time patches, and that one is creating 25% of the time patches. Now, in that case, you want to run the one that is creating 25% time of the patches,
okay,
because it has the potential to progress much faster, right, than the other two. That's the idea, but I guess we're still working on it.
Okay. Yeah, and then you also made another statement that says that one of the benefits of non-blocking write is that there's potential to increase idleness. So how would this work? I mean, why is there potential to increase idleness?
Right. The thing is that okay. Yeah.
Okay.
This field, right? So the idea is that here, you see that after we create a patch, we return directly to the process, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the point is that we have a patch in the kernel that is for that page, and we can actually issue the fetch of that page and merge that patch actually whenever we want, right? In any point in the future, as long as the application doesn't need the data. Now, that includes the case where the operating system detects that the disk is not spin up, the disk that has the data is not spin up, so it can hold that patch longer until that disk is on again. For instance, okay? That's the idea. That's how it can keep disk idle for longer. Of course, it won't work for all writes, but it will work for writes that are partial to the page.
I see. So you're essentially saying that the way essentially not waking up the disk when a read is needed.
Yes.
For data that you're actually not going to need in
exactly.
the near future.
Exactly.
Okay. Okay.
In that case, if you need to read something you wrote, do you read from the patch, or do you have to wait for the
IS? That part was completely missing from your presentation.
Oh, okay. Actually, you can
patch merging and those sorts of things.
Yeah, you can read it from the patch. You don't have to read it from
to wake up the
disk. Yeah, to wake up the disk. True.
So figure out how you're going to bring it into your presentation. Where does it go? Read from patch and patch merging and. And how you reduce some of the overheads, I think that's interesting.
True, but the presentation is rather long already.
I think you have lots of time. You have 30 slides, right?
Yeah.
Something like that. So you have, not even 30 slides, was even less than that. So, and you have 15 minutes at least. And you can get a few more slides in. I think that's one. Jorge, you finish.
Well, yeah, I'm finished with non-blocking rights. We can just address all the questions with non-blocking rights and then go.
Let's do your questions and then we can do others.
Okay, so now let me start. Go. Okay, so you assume at the almost at the beginning you said that access was designed for single disk.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't see why it cannot be used in multiple disk scenarios. I mean, there's no design limitation for that. Probably because I know the system. But
that's okay. That's fair. Yeah.
Okay.
True.
You can say rather that although it can be used
for
multi-disk, it would also work in the case of a single disk because the previous solution does not work for a single disk.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So in SRC map, you. Essentially, what you do is you're consolidating the workload into fewer disks,
mm-hmm.
right? But at some point, the I/O load will get too high, and then you have to you probably have to turn on more disks to
mm-hmm.
be able to serve more I/O, right?
Yes.
Come up because you didn't mention it in your experiment.
Sorry, repeat the last one.
That at some point, your I/O load will increase,
yes.
and you will require more disks
right.
to be able to service the load.
Yes.
Or and your experiments didn't show any trace of this happening.
Oh, okay. It did. It actually did.
If I believe correctly, you only mentioned that there was a penalty with reads that were not in the working set or something like that.
Right.
That was very few.
SRC map will increase proportionally the amount of disks that it needs depending on the load that the storage is receiving, right? So the basic idea is that if you're receiving 50% of the maximum bandwidth of the storage, then you wake up more or less 50% of the disks, right?
Okay.
So it will increase in that proportion. Now, in terms of there was a second thing you mentioned.
So essentially, the no experiments show that when that.
Oh happens, yes. Right. And yes, I mean the experiments show there are 2 hours. I think it was 2 hours where we see an increase in the number of disks used. That's because the load basically increased.
Okay, I think those are most of my major questions. The other ones are minor issues. That, for instance, things like there are some sites that don't have numbers.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
That's weird.
Look at this. So it's while the animation is happening, but after animation is happening, it comes up. Right?
It's part of the animation.
Yeah.
Light number is part of the animation.
Yeah. That's also new for me.
Okay. Yeah, and also you said. Go back a few slides, go back to slide 13. Yeah, you said small writes require disk attention. So what are small writes? You have to define it there.
Sub-page writes.
Okay, sub-page writes, okay.
And then there's, for instance, in slide 11 also,
mm-hmm.
It's not very clear to me what are the benefits there, right? If you look at there, I mean, it's not. Probably you should illustrate that at some point the disk is spun down, or you could see that there's this big span where I could turn out the disk, right? In the case of access, because
okay.
if you look at it that way, you'd say, okay, you see almost the same amount of dots in all cases,
okay.
right?
Okay.
But the idea there is that in this time. It's a huge time that I can just spin down the disk and save power.
Right, if you can have like arrows and a sleeping disk, that would be more.
Yeah, I don't know. So something to point out that this is what I want to do here.
Right, because I mean, these sorts of concepts are easier explained with figures than using words.
Yeah.
Certainly try to have more figures if you can.
Yeah, and if you go to, yeah, so. And if you go back to slide 14, sorry that I'm going back and forth.
That's fine.
Yeah, in slide 14, I mean, this is a very key slide, and you went really fast.
Yeah.
I think this one you have to take it really slow, and because, I mean, this is just the essence of the problem. And if you go through it very fast, then it's hard to follow
okay.
what's going on.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's basically all my... All my feedback.
So, Ricardo, you have some comments?
Yeah, So what is that?
Thanks. Go ahead.
Well, one is that I feel that you spend much more time and detail on non-working rights and on the other systems.
Yeah.
And given that, I mean, the other systems are much more mature, at least I would spend more time on those. It's safer, simpler, nicer, easier, you know.
Okay.
I would actually remove details from non-working rights. That would make your life easier, I guess. Also, I mean, I feel that you could show non-working rights in a more positive light. We have good results, for example, the ones for file system, but you didn't focus on those, instead you focus on the negative.
Okay. Yeah, I did mention about that, but I mean, the thing is that the only way to highlight the file server part is by using the graph, and that graph is really bold because that graph has like 10 bars and there are only 2 bars which are better. That's it. That's why I just decided just to mention it, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
But if it's good data, I mean, if it's data that supports your design, I think it's worth showing it.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, overall it sounds pretty depressing otherwise.
Because
okay.
We have to remember that work is, I mean, we also worked on that. So when you show our work, like some people, you know, it looks, I mean, feels bad. I mean, we have better results from that.
I didn't try to show it that way. And actually I tried to, at the end, try to make it more positive. So,
yeah, it didn't feel positive.
Okay.
Well, the positive side, I think what you can, it also comes up in your own belief in your work, right? I mean, it doesn't seem positive.
Okay.
The way, for instance, you brought up the multi-threaded problems and scheduling and so on. But you didn't seem convinced about the possible solutions yourself. I mean,
okay.
It was sort of okay, yeah, we can do it, and but it's not clear what we're going to get. I think for instance, I mean, when we had our discussion earlier, I said that it would be good to have like a statement saying that with all these optimizations, we think that non-blocking writes can be made to perform equivalently to blocking writes in the worst case.
Yes,
right?
That's an important.
With all these optimizations, I believe that actually.
Yeah.
I mean, I believe that if we understand the problems and fix them, then we could achieve that. And in the best case, we can have significantly better performance improvement. And you should have shown the memory sensitivity numbers because even those are good. You can show, for instance, that graph nicely illustrates that as your workload, let's say, suddenly changes the working set and memory is not enough, you go into this region where non-blocking writes actually help a lot, right? Talk about those numbers. Talk about the file system numbers, which are positive, right?
Okay. I mean, the time of the presentation is going out.
It's not, because you finished earlier than time. You finished maybe 10, 15 minutes early. So you have time.
So
and plus, this is your defense. I mean, whoever is sitting there, if it takes 5-10 more minutes, it's a big deal. You spent 5.5 years on this.
Yeah.
So, but it's important for you to be able to showcase your work well, right?
Okay.
Right. So that, Ricardo, you should continue. I was just piggybacking on your comment.
Yeah, no, that's fine. Yeah. Well, another thing is that, well, some details, for example, when you talk about non-blocking writes, page parallelism fetching and all that, I mean, that's really because that's a detail of x86 and how faults happen one after the other. But that shouldn't be the case, for example, for file system fetching. By multiple applications, for example. You can still have parallelism there.
If you have multiple threads.
Yes.
True.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah.
I guess what is missing there is that I need to set a single thread.
Yeah.
Right. And
yeah.
Also, I think you need to, for instance, talk about page faults are only one way in which non-blocking writes get engaged.
Yes.
Also, a regular write into a file system
yes.
is another way, and that part was not discussed at all. I think that's a really important part. In fact, we got reviews back saying, well, anonymous memory is not that important at all. It's file system access that's the most important for this sort of optimization, right?
Okay.
And that should be discussed.
Okay.
Well, another thing is that, I don't know, that's just for an introduction of XSYS and InfraSIMA, is that these, I mean, ideally you should put these systems together, right? Because the thing is that with InfraSIMA you go down, let's say, from 3 disks to 2 disks to 1 disk, but we, XSYS can go from 1 disk to 0 disks.
Yeah.
So it's actually part of the same big system, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, I see.
You can
actually think of XSYS as a SRC map that also has an additional size.
No,
and
SRC map would be just the part of XSYS is just the SRC map of XSYS.
You're just saying that there are orthogonal, the solutions are orthogonal to each other and they can be composed.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. But the thing is that use that for the presentation in general, right at the beginning.
You can
showcase both of them as the same. Big solution or something like that.
Okay. Yeah. Well, what I was thinking is what they're saying is that because we say that we have one level per disk, right? But what we can do using XSYS is that the last level is the flash itself.
Yeah.
So basically, you start powering up disks, and at some point you end up with the flash node.
Yes.
That's something that that's what
yes,
you're saying.
Yes. Well, the other thing is that for energy proportionality on disks, there is this word, I don't remember the name, but they use the term of gear shifting or something like
oh,
that.
Oh, yeah, gear shift, power away rate, right?
Yeah.
That for disk proportionality, right?
Yes. That's single disk proportionality. No, actually,
no,
that's also multi
disk
for RAID.
Yeah.
How do you call?
I think it's power aware RAID or
but
it's from
Kenning
and
but is that
the name of the first author?
Is that newer than
no? It's probably 2008 or something like that or
2007.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's why.
Yeah, so along the lines of connecting things, like you connect SRC map and XSYS, I thought that the connection with non-blocking writes was delayed until you completed talking about non-blocking writes, right?
Okay.
You say, okay, what we said was that this was multi-purpose and how is this multi-purpose? Which is fine because you have presented an optimization after that with the Oracle. But the problem was in the interim when you're discussing non-blocking writes, it was a completely different space than the previous.
Okay.
Maybe you can give some hint as to what this non-blocking writes allows you to do. It allows you to control IOs to storage, you can say that. And you can say that, well, I'll talk about this in more concrete terms later on, but for now, let's look at this as an independent problem so that people are put into that mode, then it's like a surprise. For me, you were talking about non-blocking rights for a while, and I sort of lost track of the connection to the previous parts of your.
Okay.
So make that connection a little bit stronger than what you have right now, if you can. Okay, so let me go to my comments. All right, so first of all, I think if you have, I like, this is after I saw Jorge's presentation, the pictorial view of your entire thesis, right,
mm-hmm.
of the various components. Right now you have that in a table. in a table of 1, 2, and 3. I think it would be nice if you convert that into a graphic somehow and show, okay, these are the three components and this is the problem space, the single disk, multi-disk, and then enabling technology, and talk about that, and that I think that would be a nice way to replace the table.
This one, right?
Yes, exactly.
So, okay. So, I think Jorge put in the...
After that one, yes.
After that. Like this one, okay.
Right. So
but I guess this...
I think that would be nice. I think that's very... I mean, although this has the same information, I think people will remember a picture for your whole thesis much better than remember this picture.
Okay.
So that's one. I think for me, this is important. I mean, it is important to stay consistent with your terminology, right? So for instance, spinning down disk drives, disk going to sleep, are two different things, right? But they actually mean the same thing. It is better to use the same terminology.
Okay.
Than to have two separate ones. So that's something to keep in mind. Early on you say that CPU is proportional. But before you say that, you need to say what you mean by proportional.
Okay.
What you mean by energy proportional. Right? And then after you say that CPU is more energy proportional, you have to say a little bit why. Because remember that in the audience, there will be non-experts and there will be people
who... Yeah, I have a comment about that.
Right. There would be people who don't really know what you mean by proportional. And they won't even know what you mean by CPU is proportional.
Okay.
Right. So talk about those. Spend a little bit more time on the background and it's better that way. And it was a little confusing when you initially started talking about energy efficient multi-disk system. You said, well, you replicate data in many disks and then you shut off a few disks to save power.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I know where you're going with this, but the audience could be confused because they might think, why would you want to first replicate, create so many replicas only to shut many of them down?
Okay.
So think about how you can convey that message without creating that confusion. Or what would you say, or how would you sequence the statements while you're speaking so that people are not left wondering that. Because much later on when you bring up the list of related words, that's when you say, we actually go into the detail why you would have multiple replicas. Right? You want to say that systems are provisioned for peak load and that might require so many disk drives, but then at a later point if there is a possibility to reduce the number of disks to serve data, then you would reduce the number of replicas that serve the data. Okay, so just think about how you're going to say that to avoid the confusion. The other thing is when you talk about the related work with external caching, right?
Mm-hmm.
You said something like existing solution is usually simulation.
Mm-hmm.
It is simulation. Just say it is simulation. It was all simulation studies so far. Right? Because usually might indicate that maybe there are some which are not simulation.
True. True.
And maybe there are because some might be simply analytical. So you say either simulation or analytical studies, but no one had explored whether these ideas would be practical or not. Right? The slide title should be thesis statement and not problem statement. Slide 5. Also, I mean, this is again because there will be non-experts in the audience. You want to say what a logical volume is. So one way in which you can say very simply is logical volume could be a file system instance, or it could be a virtual disk that stores many file systems. So talk about that just a little bit, not go into any detail. I'm not saying that you had to formally define logical volume, but just give the audience some sense of what you mean when you say logical volume. And then that will also, because later on you also say that moving logical volumes is expensive. When you tell them what a logical volume is, then that next statement also makes more sense.
Okay.
Right? Why is it expensive? Because moving file systems and all the data contained in them is expensive.
Yeah.
Right, so in slide number 8, let me go to slide number 8. Is that a summary slide? No, it's not a summary slide. Okay, slide number 8.
Nine. This is summary.
No, actually I meant slide number 8. Okay. So here you want to say that in this picture itself, you should probably talk about misses. Read misses, because you don't, right? And the key point here is that although read misses will require spinning up inactive disks, because if the working sets are characterized accurately and carefully, we expect that the number of misses are going to be small, right? And then in your summary slide, you actually have a number, which is nice. In the experiment, you show that it's 0.00 something percent. So, but here it's important to talk about the misses.
Okay.
Okay. And then I think summary slide, the next one. In that, you say something about. There are a couple of things here. One is the. Do you say something about synchronization IOs?
Yeah.
Synchronization IOs was not introduced. You didn't tell us what synchronization IOs were.
Okay.
So introduce the term before you use it. Maybe you can describe it even in the previous slide with the picture. Because it's nice to look at the picture and when you're talking, right? Instead of looking at this slide when you're introducing new terminology.
Okay.
Okay. And then here you have something which you call minimal initial manual tuning. What is that? What does that manual tuning involve?
Well, the thing is that you set up a new SRS system, and then when you want to set up SRC map, you don't have to tune much. Just a couple of knobs, and then you have SRC map up and running. And the idea is that after that initial tuning, the administrator doesn't have to do anything else.
Right, but what exactly is that tuning? I mean, what does that involve? What steps?
I still don't understand
it.
Okay.
Someone might wonder about it.
Okay.
And why do you think it is minimal?
Okay.
Right. Just give some description of what that tuning is, so that people are convinced that it's very little, really there is no human effort involved.
Okay.
Because there isn't, right?
Yeah.
And for instance, things like how much history would accurately represent working sets and those sorts of, that is really what you want, right?
Yeah.
So, So I think that before you talk about the non-blocking, go to slide 13. What is slide 13?
13?
Yeah, slide 13. Right here. So this is the transition slide from excess to non-blocking rights.
Yes, right. Yes. How non-blocking rights will use excess and SRC map.
Right, so I think you talk about that nicely, but one missing piece of information here is that disk drives are accessed at the granularity of pages.
Okay.
Right. Again, for the non-expert.
Okay.
Because it is implied that that information, right, we all know that, but there might be someone in the audience who doesn't know that fact. There is a larger granularity of access for disk drives, and therefore, when there is a miss, you need to fetch the entire page into memory before you can use it, right? And then, when you go to the next slide with the figure, it's also much clearer.
Okay.
If you're writing, you're fetching the entire page. It's a nice connection.
Yes, right.
In slide, what is this? Yeah, slide 17. Go to slide 17. Right. So here in slide 17. So here, wasn't this multi-purpose? Yeah, I think the whole term multi-purpose is a little confusing. It's not specific to what you really want to say is that this idea can also be used for energy saving, right? Okay. Besides performance. This multi-purpose is even more abstract than saying that, right? So I think this can be, first of all, instead of putting it in the slide, you can say recall that earlier, and for this you have to actually state this earlier, the connection between non-blocking writes and energy saving very briefly.
Okay.
By saying that what are the operations that that reduce the efficiency of the previous solutions when there are misses, right? Misses reduce the efficiency of XS and
yeah.
SRC now,
yeah.
Right? And then you can that way connect what you're going to present next with non-blocking writes to the previous solutions, because non-blocking writes allow you to handle misses much more efficiently.
Yes.
And even in such a way that the misses do not affect energy consumption, right? And you say, here you can, instead of saying that wasn't this multipurpose, you can say, but I told you earlier that non-blocking writes helps with energy consumption, and now let's see how it does.
Okay.
Then it's much clearer.
Okay.
Okay. What is an 18? Right here, I think what you can also say in terms of impact, remember that in your first slide you said memory consumes 30% energy and disk consumes 10%, and all the things that you talked about in your presentation is only about 10%, right?
Mm-hmm.
So how can you make this more relevant to 30%? One way is to argue that non-blocking writes allow you to work more efficiently with lesser memory, right? And that's why I said that it makes sense for you to do the memory sensitivity chart to make that point. Say, okay, as you reduce the amount of physical memory that's available, you actually see non-blocking writes actually performing better than current systems. So one way to utilize non-blocking writes is to operate with lower memory, thereby consuming less DRAM energy, right? That's one.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, I have another suggestion for your future work, which I'll come to along these same lines. Does that make sense, though?
Yeah.
I mean, in the Oracle uses, you can say that.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the uses. It's not just to help systems under resource pressure, but also to enable systems to operate with lesser memory and therefore consume less energy.
Okay.
Yeah, so the chart in 20, Uh, Yeah, the chart in 20, actually, I think before you say percentage improvement, you have to say very quickly that a percentage improvement actually means reduction in time.
Okay.
I don't know if you said it, maybe I missed it, but if you didn't, just say that.
Proper idea.
Yeah. Percentage improvement, the improvement in time, and it's not clear whether it's an increase or decrease.
Yeah.
Just state it explicitly.
That 6.2 is seconds, so it is.
No, it's percentage. It's percentage. Yeah, I never talk about.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Here.
I never talk about absolute numbers.
Yeah, so here the 2.1% gain out of 6.2% maximum, right?
Yes.
That came out of the blue. It was very surprising. I know what you mean by that, but no one, I think no one will understand why you're saying that.
Why 6.2%?
Yeah, why is there even a maximum in the first place?
Oh, okay.
Right. And what do you mean by this statement?
I guess, I said 6.2% is because, just to lower the expectations of people thinking that non-blocking rights will have a benefit of 50% time reduction, right?
That's the next point I'm trying to make. This all of these numbers are based on some assumptions of how much physical memory you have.
Oh, I see. Right.
I think that's, I want you to get into that mode, into a mode of thinking where you understand that all the numbers that you see here are under certain assumptions of memory size.
Right? Okay.
And think about the memory sensitivity experiment, that as you lower memory, the performance improvement actually increases, right? And keep that in mind, because it seems to me, based on the way you deliver the presentation, is that you're not completely convinced that this is a good idea. It was not, you were not as
no, I'm not trained.
But you presented a lot of negative results, right?
Yeah, we both feel that.
But that's a result I have.
Right, I mean, but you're hiding results. I think it's the same as...
I don't know, for some reason I thought the negative results was the more interesting one. That doesn't mean I don't believe in non-blocking rights.
The negative results are based on assumptions, which may or may not be true. That's my whole point, right? I mean, you assume that there is a certain amount of physical memory here and you got these numbers.
Okay.
And then I told you to do the memory sensitivity study, and we saw that at different amounts of memory, the performance improvements are different. And as you go lower in the amount of physical memory, your improvements actually increase.
Okay.
Right? And think about workloads which are not static like these benchmarks, where there is a lot of dynamic usage of memory. When these workloads change from one working set to another, non-blocking writes can actually respond much better, right? Because the amount of effective physical memory that's available to store the working set is much lower suddenly because the working set changed, right? Okay. And that's the same as doing an experiment with much lesser amount of physical memory for these static workloads, right? And then you see the performance difference that you get for that sort of behavior. And you should bring that up.
Yeah. I was starting to think that it's probably better to take Ricardo's suggestion and remove most of the selection of non-blocking rights and start bringing up SRC map and XRC.
Why?
Because
it makes more sense.
Because the thing is that, I mean, well, first it seems like all the results I have are negative. So
well, in this presentation, yes. But, I mean, the ones that you don't put in the presentation are all positive, actually, if you think about it.
I mean, well, but how much more positive? I mean, in the case of the memory sensitivity, we have a maximum of 5.8% of gain, right?
Because we couldn't go any lower than that.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, yeah. It was increasing until it hit.
It was increasing, but it wasn't increasing even linearly, right?
We don't know. I mean, the thing is, all of this is workload dependent, right? And we did sensitivity for only one workload. And we saw that for that one workload, there was actually improvement as you go to lower memory sizes. We haven't done it with other workloads.
Yeah.
So, I feel like we haven't done enough evaluation to conclude anything about non-blocking right here.
Okay.
And plus,
okay.
For the multi-threaded workloads, we don't have a good enough implementation.
Yes.
And we have ideas, and it's important to talk about those, right? That there are results that seem to be discouraging, or that seem to, let's not use the word discouraging, but that seem to indicate that the potential for non-blocking rights with multi-threaded workloads is limited, right? But we don't have proper, fully optimized implementation that will conclusively show that.
Okay.
And here are some optimizations that we think will help the performance of even the existing workloads, right? I think you had to state these things more explicitly. Otherwise, I think the full message doesn't come across. You could, of course, choose to say, I'm going to spend less time on non-blocking rights and spend more time on XSS and SRC now. And that's perfectly fine. The reason I think this is also okay is because we already talked about XSS and SRC map during your proposal exam.
Yeah.
Right. It may be okay to have one slide each additionally for each of those systems. So you spend a little bit more time on those. But really, I mean, this is the more interesting stuff that you are currently engaged in, right?
I know. Yeah.
It's just that you have to change your, or at least have a little bit more positive view on this.
Put happy faces all over the place. Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know what it is, but I don't think this is not going to work. I don't think the results are bad, for instance.
The ones you showed were not very good with the multi-threaded.
2.1% won't change.
That's why I'm saying that it's out of a maximum of 3.2. That was the point of point itself. I mean, my point was that it was not going to be 50% because it can't be.
But then the issue is then, why are you doing all this just to get a potentially maximum benefit of 6.2%?
That needs to go away. Because that maximum doesn't mean anything. That means
because that's some assumption, like Roger said.
But that's an assumption of a certain physical memory size. Mm-hmm. With that physical memory size, you have a 6.2% maximum.
Okay.
In fact, it will just keep going up as you reduce the physical memory size because you'll wait more for I/O.
Yeah.
Right? And you'll have maybe the same amount of asynchronous fetches in terms of percentage. But you have much more percentage of I/O waiting time, that number is going to go up.
Yeah. Well, so far it was, instead of 6.2, it was like 7.
That's because you made certain assumptions about memory size, right?
Okay.
Do the same calculation for a much lower memory size, and that could even be, I would say, 50% maximum. Say you spend 90%, 95, 99% of your time waiting for I/O.
Yeah, the thing is that one of the things I saw when you reduce memory is that many of the new fetches or the new faults is because of reads, right? Because now you also introduce write faults, but you also introduce a lot of read faults for which non-blocking write, you know, can offer benefits.
Okay. I think that's data we don't have yet completely. So it's just better to remove that line. I don't think we should go into that maximum potential. I think what is important to say here is that these are with certain assumptions of memory size, but we also did a sensitivity to the memory size for one of these workloads and then show that in the next slide.
Okay.
Because here a 2.1% gain, in the next slide you see that there is a trend towards increasing gains as you reduce memory size.
Yeah, but then, okay, that's fine. But then I guess I have a little imbalance. I mean, I'm spending way too much time in non-blocking. So I can probably remove the scaling problem from the presentation, I don't know.
Well, you could spend less time talking about this and just hit on the high-level points. Now, after you talk about the single-threaded workloads, introduce the results for the multi-threaded workloads and just say that we saw that performance was much worse with multi-threaded workloads, right? Instead of going into the details, say that I'm going to skip out the details of these numbers, because I think you spent a lot of time talking about the numbers, and then talk about the solutions, because the solutions are the more interesting ones.
I mean, this,
because I'm
right?
sure that Ming Zhao will have those same questions that he had last session. Right? And you actually have some solutions to answer some of his questions.
Yeah. So what you're saying is that not presenting these numbers, but definitely present this problem of...
Yeah, and also argue that you think with these optimizations that the worst case performance of non-blocking writes will be equivalent or equal to blocking writes.
Okay.
And in the best case, it will do much better.
Okay.
That's what we believe right now. At least I do. I think that there are these problems with the current implementation that need fixing.
Yeah. I agree. I mean, the thing is that at this point, I'm not convinced. That's what I'm not convinced that it will guarantee that the time will be the same if it doesn't have benefits.
Because think about it, non-blocking writes can have the same schedule as blocking writes. Schedule the CPU in exactly the same way and you'll have the same performance. It's just a question of figuring out when
true.
To do that.
Yes,
right?
True, okay. But the thing is that now you will have, well, no, actually you won't.
No, you just block,
right?
I mean, for the workloads where non-blocking writes doesn't help, just do blocking writes.
Yeah. Okay.
The challenge is how to figure out how to figure out that's necessary.
Okay. Yeah.
We have a system that is sufficiently dynamic that we can switch from one option to the other.
Yes.
Okay. So. Right, so 22. Oh, that's the one. Yeah. Maybe it's 23 then. Go to the next one. Ah, yeah, 23. Right, so the numbers that you show here, right, I think it's important to stress again, if you have not done enough already, that these are with specific assumptions.
Okay.
This is a summary, and the summary doesn't look very good.
Okay.
Right. So I would say make 36% also into a range to be more consistent with the next bullet.
That makes sense.
So I think 36%, again, this is going back to the to how you present it, whether you want to present it positively or negatively, right? Because you presented the minimum number there.
Yeah.
So present the range.
Okay.
Make it a little bit more positive.
Okay. Okay. That's fine. I guess I have that way in the conclusion. So.
Okay. So the future works like. Right. So so Lewis is looking for suggestions for future work.
Yeah.
Here's a crazy suggestion. Does it make sense to have when DRAM is the most energy consuming resource in the system? And the only way to reduce power, and you optimize everything else, the only way to reduce power is to reduce the amount of DRAM you use. What would you do? You know, what makes sense? I mean, of course, you can do non-blocking writes, but non-blocking writes is somewhat limited because it can only help you with the writes that block and maybe reads to patches. and then you can save some pages by not retrieving them at all or retrieving them when it is more convenient. But what else can you do to reduce the amount of physical memory that you need? Does it make sense? For instance, one of the things I say here is that does it make sense to manage DRAM at sub-page granularity instead of page granularity?
I thought that non-blocking writes was a good chance to manage pages in a sub-page way, because you can actually bring. I thought about that before, but I thought then that was not a good idea. Right? But,
okay, I just thought about it when you had the feature.
The thing is that you can instead of fetching a whole page, you can actually fetch half a page and then make a patch out of it, right? And then you can read from it with the infrastructure we have and so on. But then, you know, you will have a lot of...
I mean, does it make sense to look at page utilization distribution, right? For instance, if I bring in an entire page, do I actually read all the bytes of the page? Or is my page access more localized and concentrated?
I see. Okay.
In sub-pages, right? And that way, can I use the infrastructure that you already have with the patches to have sub-pages?
Yeah. There are companies actually working on that. Fusion.io is working on that sort of problem.
Okay. Okay, so think about something like that. I don't know about what Fusion.io is doing, but if the only way to reduce power is by reducing physical memory size, then one logical thing to do is to
reduce
the granularity of management of that resource. So you could try that. You've already done it with patches in a somewhat different way, but can you generalize it to something like subpages?
I wonder if the MMU of CPU support pages of less granular size than 4K. I think there is 1K.
4K and 4 megabytes. But that's not the point. I mean, you can say that there are two ways, right? Make the hardware support subpages.
Yeah. Or use.
Or you do it using software, like you do it with non-blocking.
But then, I guess the big problem there is, I mean, the challenge is the faults itself, right?
Yeah, you would have more faults.
Much more faults.
Then maybe your CPU scheduling optimizations become much more important, right?
So, I mean, why do you have to fault? Let's say, why don't you do something like, I don't want to write it in place, but write it out of place?
I mean, the application changes its logic, or?
Yeah, I mean, exactly. I mean, you don't need to retrieve that data all the time. You could just write it somewhere else.
So change the application?
No, instead of, because the idea behind non-blocking writes is that you have to read the data, merge it, and then write. What happens?
You don't need to write, actually. Writing is an optional thing.
Writing is an optional thing. But what happens is when you get that and you say, okay, I don't have the data, let me just write it somewhere else temporarily.
It's a patch. We call it a patch.
Yeah, but exactly. But instead of just keeping that in memory, I'll just write it, let's say, to some sequential device or somewhere else.
You're talking about persistent patches.
Persistent patches.
So there are directions in the proposal that I sent you, right? Persistent patches is one of them.
Mm.
And you can look at that proposal also for other possible extensions.
I mean, of course, I mean, that will not work if you're constantly pausing on that page, but it might work for some cases where you just fault once. You just have a workload that's writing to that page and wrote only once and stuff like that.
Yeah, the advantage of doing that is that you free up the patch memory.
You free up the patch memory and then you
don't need to read the original page.
Yeah, and you can extend the sleep time on the devices, for instance.
Right. But if there is a sync operation and you have a patch that's the only thing that needs to be written, then you could actually write to whichever device is active instead of the original device.
Mm-hmm.
But this is something that made me think about changing the application. You can actually change the application. Let's say you do something crazy like you look ahead one instruction, and let's say the instruction ahead of you wants to write to some non-existent page. You can change it in binary. You can change the binary.
But you can do that even in kernel.
What's the idea behind what you're saying?
Let's say calling is too expensive.
Okay, I see. Yes.
One thing you can do actually is that you, but I don't know how hard is that. I mean, because, well, there could be cycles and so on, but I also thought of this idea where, let's say you have, you do that analysis in kernel, right? Where anyway, disassembling instructions anyway.
Disassemble the next one.
Right, so you disassemble it, not the next one, but in the next 5 or 10 ones, right?
Yeah.
Actually, you can do some kind of refresh in there.
But that's more complicated because then you'll have to see how effective your read refresh is. And
yeah, and not only that, I mean, you need to guess, for
exactly.
instance, what happens if you have these friends.
You need to start guessing, and it gets more complicated.
Well, no, but, I mean, it could be impossible that this just for future work. The idea is also saying that, I mean, you don't have any future work idea.
Everything is done.
You have a billion future work ideas. Just for not looking right.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a lot that's also in the proposal that you can. I completely forgot about that.
Yeah, you could also mention the hybrid disk that you originally started
hybrid memory.
With, right? Hybrid memory.
Yeah, the thing with hybrid memory is that
you already mentioned it.
Hybrid memory is one direction, and then the sub-page memory is another direction.
Yeah.
Right? Both possibly leading to the same goal.
Yeah.
Persistent patches.
What about non-blocking writes? We had this idea of actually patching instructions.
Yeah.
For example, that a new world of
crazy.
No, I mean, I put patching instructions, but the thing is that I guess at some point we change to, you know, global kind of future work, because the patching instruction is very specific.
It's very specific. Yeah, I think you need to have some more global plan. I think the memory approach of reducing memory energy consumption is a good theme.
It's a good theme.
And
yeah.
You have these ideas that follow along that path.
Yeah.
The patching instruction patches are more sort of fine-grained, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, but I think overall, I mean, I think I mentioned this earlier, but I feel it's important to reiterate, which is that you want, when you talk about non-blocking rights, do talk about the file system aspect of non-blocking rights.
Yeah, I forgot completely, but my plan was to at least say that this also applies for file system, right?
Not just in that way, but say that, keep these at least in the same level of importance, right?
Okay.
Rather than first talk about anonymous memory and then say, oh yeah, this also applies to file systems. Because a lot of people argue, and I tend to agree, that this optimization for file systems is probably more important than for anonymous memory in many situations, right? In other situations, it might be the reverse. In the energy situation, it might be, if you think about XS and SRC map, SRC map is a storage level optimization, and if you build non-blocking, or if you improve it with non-blocking rights, it would all be for file system, right? So think about it. I mean, they are, in fact, there's no reason to put one or the other above.
True. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when you give an example, talk about both, right? And that picture that you have with the fault, the write and the miss, I think it's generic enough that it includes both.
Yeah, in fact, I instead of saying fault, I said miss because of that.
Yeah, and when you say miss, you can say at that point that this miss could be because of file system page not being cached in memory, or it could be because of a virtual memory page not in physical memory.
Okay.
I think that overall the theme is good. I mean, you don't really have to increase the amount of time you spend on XS and SRC map, but if you want to, that's fine as well.
Mm-hmm.
But you certainly need to spend more time relatively on non-blocking bytes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, good. So, it's Monday, right?
Yes.
Monday morning.
11 also, right?
11, yeah. Apparently, it's the only time I work for Singapore and California at the same time.
Okay.
All right.
Good thing we don't have anyone in Europe.
I sent you an email with my comments. And I'll also upload this audio.
Okay.
It has some good comments for you. See you guys. Okay.
Ricardo, by the way,
if you want, we can meet in about 5 minutes.
Yeah, sure.
Because I have to make a phone call first.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, just come over in 5 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you.